So we're sitting here with Mike Haglin. He's one of the owners of Aero Alaska.
He started off flying in Alaska in the early 80s and running an airline called 70s, an airline called Haglund Aviation. And we're just going to sit down and sort of get a feel for what it's like flying in Alaska over the last 30 plus years, and kind of how Mike got up here and started flying and took it from a single airplane, single pilot operation to what is arguably the largest air taxi / airline in Alaska today. I don't even know if it's arguably, I think it is.
It's far bigger than anyone, maybe in the whole United States, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, it's 50, 60 airplanes, something like that. So let's go back to, let's just start right at the beginning. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Minnesota, northern Minnesota.
Northern Minnesota, so Alaska's not much of a...
It's warmer than it was in Minnesota.
Cool. When you grew up, did you work on a farm? What was your background?
Yeah, I grew up on a farm, and I never flew it and got in an airplane until I think I was 16, and this guy landed on a road with a Piper Pacer or a Colt, I can't remember which, and my dad asked him if he'd give us a ride, me and my brother, a ride in a town. I think it was a Colt. He says, sure. You know, just see it. And I just really thought that was cool. That was the best thing ever.
You hadn't thought about planes before that, or flying, or
just never
had that in your head?
You very seldom saw airplanes back then. I mean, you see a DC-3 passing over way out of sight just about. But yeah, when I was on the farm, it was pretty isolated.
So is that the 60s?
That would have been in the 50s sometime.
Okay, 50s.
Late 50s.
How much longer from that first flight to when you started flying yourself?
I'd say it was 60, so I started in 70. Started flying.
Okay, so you started
taking my private pilot's license.
Of course, you did that just at an airport somewhere with a flight instructor?
Yeah, I came up here first. I went to service, met a guy from Sleep Butte, Alaska in Germany. We became good friends, and when I left, he says, come on. You know, he told me all kinds of stories about dog mushing and farting around out in the village, having a good time. And he said, hey, come on up here. We'll find something to do. He says, come up. I'll get out of the service. So I got out of the service and bummed around for about 7 months in the lower 48 and headed up here.
Which service were you in?
In the Army.
In Germany. So then you learned how to fly before...
I came up first, and then I spent 6 months in Bethel. I spent the summer in Bethel, and I didn't know a soul there because he'd moved back to Sleep Butte and didn't tell me. So I got there with $30 in my pocket, and it cost $60 for a ticket back to Anchorage.
So you were stuck.
So I was kind of stuck there. But then, I came into Anchorage for the winter, and then I headed outside, started working on my mechanics license, my pilot's license, because I met a guy here with an air taxi, and I was working as a mechanic, and he said if I got my mechanics license and pilot's license, he'd hire me. Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah, so you're kind of looking for some sort of career, some sort of job to get into.
Well, I knew it. That was the kind of thing, after I'd been up here, I could see that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah, yep.
And it's just great.
So that was probably mid-70s.
But it was great.
So what was aviation like in that Bethel, the Yukon, Kuskokwim Delta region?
When I was in Bethel, there was Jimmick Samuelson had an operation. He had four airplanes. He had a 180, I think, and three 185 on 185s on floats, and then of course put them on wheels and skis in the winter, I think, or maybe just skis. I can't find out. I wasn't there for the winter. And there was
There weren't many airports.
No, there weren't many airports. They land on floats. They had to have floats pretty much because most of the villages out there didn't have airports. They taxi up on the mud up to the coast. Taxi back down, and there was three operators, I think. There was Christensen and Salison. Salison had a 180. Christensen had a Porter and a 180. And his Porter was the first one I worked on as a mechanic. But, it was very primitive. It was all air taxi except for Ween, and Ween had a couple twin otters in Bethel that they would do the whole Delta with on a schedule about twice a week. They could hit every place or once a week.
And those were on floats or skis?
No. Nope. Twin otters were on wheels. They didn't have anything on floats.
So they missed some of the more remote villages then?
No service to some of those villages.
What were you? I know nowadays we fly a lot of groceries bypass mail, mm-hmm. and pastors are kind of subsidized by that mail. In those days, what were you flying? What was the primary load?
Well, in 72, when we first started, it was all charter, of course, and it was people wanting to go up to Red Devil to get booze, or somebody wanting to go visit somebody over here at funerals. They'd scrape together a few dollars that they could go, you know, firefighters coming home, they'd want to go home.
Okay.
It was pretty sparse. It was pretty...
Here in the hidden.
There wasn't a lot of money. And, there was a lot of money on the Yukon, usually more money on the Yukon in the summertime because it get paid for fishing.
Okay.
But so it wasn't that much on the Kuskokwim.
Did you get much fish hauling in, or is that not a...
We did some of that in 72 when I first started. We did some fish hauling. The guy I was working for was buying fish. And he bought fish from the Russian Mission and from Kalskag. Okay. We just throw them in the back of the airplane and haul them to Antioch. It's a mess.
Yeah, the plane always smells good after
always,
that.
Yeah, there was
and
not
no,
much of that.
And no nav aids or any...
Nope. No nav aids. There was a VOR in Bethel, and there was an ADF in St. Mary's that I never could get to work with the crap, but the VOR was good. But of course, you know, you pick that up at a low altitude.
Right. When you ended up in Mountain Village at some point.
Yeah, I started in Antioch and started flying for a guy, and then I wrecked his float plane in fall time and fixed that, but his brother wrecked the other one in the same day that I wrecked it. I tipped that one over in the water and landed and broke a stinger, a weld on a stinger broke and ground boot and got the wing on it, so I had to fix that one too. And so it just took him down. He made bad decisions. And then, so I was out of a job for a year. I built a house over there. And my wife was working, and then she got transferred from Antioch. Next fall, she got transferred to Marshall.
She was a teacher, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So went to Marshall, and I was a trapper for a year. That was kind of cool.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That would be cool.
And then I got hired by a principal at Pictus Point and bought the air taxi certificate. He wanted to expand it a little bit at St. Mary's. So Larry was working for him at the time. He talked him into hiring me, so I started flying there in 74, summer, spring 74. And I flew for that company until 81. And the guy that I'd flown for before bought the company, but he was back to his old bad decision making, and I couldn't stop him from going broke, so I got my own certificate. I'd already had the 180 because I was leasing it out to the company and flying at the same time. So cool. I had that.
And that was 361, which
yep.
Jim flies around
75.
Today. Yep. Yeah.
Plus 1975.
Saw it the other day. It looks like I need another paint job.
Yep.
Needs a little work, but still looks good.
But we had gotten transferred to Mountain 77.
Get a lot of school charters then?
That was the main reason I got into business for myself, because I was right there at the headquarters of the school district and they had so much business. I was doing it all anyway, so, or so much of it anyway, so I just kept on track, and that's what built the business really.
So you operated 361 out of Mountain Village on your own for how many years before you?
From September, I started September 11th, 1981, and then in March, late March or early April of 82, I got a new 207. And then in June, brought a partner on.
Oh, was that Hawkins? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you were partners with Hawkins for a long time, from the early 80s?
Yeah, from 82 until 95, I guess.
And he was down in Bethel?
Yeah.
All the whole time, not just?
Well, he was in Mountain for, I think, 2 years or maybe even 3 years. I can't remember when we were in Mountain and we were flying up a storm.
Cool.
And he just wanted to get back over to Bethel, so he went over and started operating out of there. That was after ATC. You know, when I first started, you couldn't even get a certificate. We couldn't have done it. Because ATC was a protection type of deal.
ATC stands for?
Alaska Transportation Commission.
Okay, yeah, I hadn't heard of that. That's and still around?
No.
Okay.
No, they got disbanded. You can come in, yeah. Just didn't need them anymore. It got deregulated.
Okay.
So you just started up. But back then you had to get approval from them to get a certificate, ATC certificate to operate.
What was it like operating on a mountain? Was it, what did you do in the morning? Did you get up, just go to the plane, sweep the wings,
get up, look out the window and check the weather and just let me see across the river. And it was all charter, so maybe you'd have nothing to do.
Yeah, nothing happened, you sit.
Huh?
Nothing happened, you go fishing or go trapping or sit on your ass.
Well, I could do a lot of things. I did have somebody else to answer the phone, wire the phone to this other person's house, so I could get her to answer the phone. We didn't have radios or anything, so.
Yeah, no marine radios or anything.
We had CDs at first.
Okay.
And then we got marine radios shortly after, maybe right when I started operating, because they were much, much better to, for transmission and
right.
For lack of chatter, because you didn't see me, I couldn't understand anything, but you get so many people hollering on it all the time.
Was it pretty nice with I noticed this when I was flying the mountains, I was always flying the same people, the same teachers,
mm-hmm.
We were still doing a lot of school charters, and that was 96, I think.
Yeah.
And it seems like you get the same people, and it's kind of fun. You show up, and they know you, them.
Yeah. It was great, because I just built a business on it. I mean, they'd never had service. I can't say that, because I'd give them service, but...
Not much.
But they didn't have somebody that cared about being on time.
Right.
And I said, that's unacceptable to me. If I say I'm going to be someplace at a certain time, I'm going to be there.
Yeah, we're going to be a Hooper 10, we're going to leave here.
Yeah.
Nine and go from there.
Yeah, so
when you partnered with Hawkins and he went down to Bethel, were you both thinking more about actually kind of expand and become, or were you still just sort of having fun with it?
I don't know. I didn't give much thought to expanding, but you're kind of forced into it.
Either shrink and go away or get bigger.
The only reason I took on a partner in the first place is because I started in September, and in March I think I flew 130 hours with them, 80 or something like that. I mean, I was just flying all the time. I couldn't take care of all the business, and I couldn't stand not being able to take care of all the business. So I told Hawkins, in fact, I told him, it took me 5 years to get retired.
Well, that worked well for you.
That worked real well, yeah.
He retired.
It's his fault because he moved the operation over to Bethel.
Yep.
But
so your primary motivator was you wanted to provide good service.
That's exactly right. I just couldn't stand that. I just couldn't stand what they were having. It was pathetic.
Okay, so now you're going through the 80s. You're with Hawkins. You're adding 207s as you go.
Yeah, we put that first one on in 82, and then we bought another new one in 83, I think. like I wrecked the first one. Les Williams wrecked the first one. And we got 00 Mike, I think we bought next.
Oh, 00, that was still around when I showed up.
Yeah, it's still there now.
Yeah, good deal.
But it was used then.
Did you notice the, like, were runways getting added? I mean, how is it?
They were always getting, yeah, they were always
here
getting
and there.
Improved. They kept adding to them and improving them here and there, but they never did enough. It wasn't like up north where they made big runways. You know, that's why we kept, and they're still using 207s in the state because they don't have the runways for anything else. Not
right, they've gotten, they've continued to get better since I've been
here. Oh, yeah,
which
much better.
Is nice. Like East now, they've Accio to improve.
Oh, yeah, they're all good.
They're always getting better.
But they still. But you know, I mean, in the 70s and 80s, all they must have had better representation up north because they got big runways and all that kind of
oil
stuff.
Money.
Yeah? Well, that's way up north. But I'm talking about Nome area.
No,
they
no,
got
no.
They had some stroke up there in Cottonsville. Nome area must have had some. Foster was their representative for years. I think he must have had some. Either pretty smart or had some stroke.
Yeah, you're right. Actually, when I showed up, in Bethel, the runways were always the worst on Bethel. The further mm-hmm. north you got, the better they got.
Yep.
You did it more dark, so you had lights, more lights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we never had lights. We never had lights at all. I remember, God dang it, when I was living in Marshall, I had PA-12. This must have been 75, probably 74. I got that in 74, so it must have been 70. Maybe that winter, or that fall. As a matter of fact, and I went, Don Hunter wanted to go pick up his wife, but I didn't, you know, 20, and it's over in St. Mary's. I said, well, I'll take him, yeah, I'll go over and take you over to 180, or to PA-12, and pick Zena up and bring her back. Damn, jet was late. Darker, told his ass when he got him, Mama, come back, Mama. And of course, I didn't have landing lights. The only thing that thing had on it was position lights. Had no instrument lights. And a turning bank, you know, you could kind of see it because it had that fluorescent, arm on it. So you could kind of see that. I mean, I couldn't see it because it's dark in the airplane. And I had to try to land there on a 1,200-foot strip in the dark with it. Two people and myself.
Well, at least with a Cub, you know, if you hit anywhere within the last couple hundred feet, you get stuff.
Not on a 12. They don't, that thing seemed like it was faster now. It didn't have flaps or anything, you know.
Oh,
it was just a standard 12 with 180 horse engine. And then they come down with lights. Everybody had their trucks out there and shining lights in my eyes and shining lights. Anyway, I got it.
Cool. So you eventually teamed up with the Tweedos when they were up
in the that was in 89 I met. It was really funny because I was landed at St. Mary's and didn't know anything from Adam. And he was flying for Ryan at that time. And I landed at St. Mary's, and when I was getting ready to take off, the fog had really come in. I mean, it was crappy when I landed, but it was really foggy when I left. So I heard this airplane and I heard this guy talking, he was coming in there, and I said, okay, I'm going to take off and hit from out. I got out of there and I just, I talked to somebody the next day and they said, yeah, I made it in. Who the hell is he? I got hired, you know? So when I saw him down the mountain, I went over and talked to him. I said, hey, you need to go to work for me. Shit, he did.
So he did. So that's, I didn't know that. Okay, so Ron started flying for you just as a pilot.
Yeah, in 89.
And then eventually him and Jim bought in.
Well, in 90, my wife decided that she was going to retire. Since we're living in teacher's housing, and she says, I'm out of here, this is it, I'm gone.
Done with the village life.
Yep, and I said, well, I suppose I better go with you then, you know.
Yeah, she can't leave you unsupervised.
Huh?
She shouldn't leave you unsupervised.
Yeah, so Tom says, that's fine. He said, he told me a long time ago, he says, when you guys leave, he says, I'm out of here. When you guys quit, I'm quit. You know, because I ain't doing all the paperwork and everything.
He didn't want to do that.
He didn't want to do that. He dealt with the FAA, because I wouldn't deal with them, but he wouldn't do that accounting paperwork.
Yeah.
So anyway, we were just going to sell out. We didn't have any assets to speak of, you know. We tanks, a couple of tanks, and we had built a building in St. Louis at that time. But we were just gonna quit, get out of it. Then Ron says, well, he says, my brother's got a, we've got an operation up in Uniclete. He says, we could join up with you and, partners, and he said, we can run a business out of here. I said, I can run a business. Well, because I knew we didn't have enough money to retire. I mean, Christ the French.
Well, you still don't.
No, I still don't. And so I said, yeah, okay, we can try that.
But Ron was a pusher.
Oh, he was a driver. He was just a driver. I mean, we got the Beach 18s cleaned up and put together, running, so they ran on both engines all the time instead of just once in a while. Pieces of shit. We spent 3 months, Merrill and I spent three, it was either three or four months we spent on the damn 6.5 Delta fixing it up. I mean, we fixed everything. I mean, went through that damn thing, changed the engine. God, we spent a lot of time on it.
Well, I mean, even when I showed up, they didn't fly all that often.
No, they were. By that time, we'd gotten the caravans, And
oh yeah, that's it. You got the first caravan in '95.
But see, we couldn't. That airplane is a pilot's airplane. It's not just. It's just not for anybody.
That's the Beach 18.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It wants to go the other way. It wants to. The tail wants to lead that way. And if you're not on top of it, I mean, I had trying to check Dick.
Oh, I know you're talking about Chandler, yep.
Dick Chandler out in it.
Yeah.
And I flew with him quite a bit, and he's got a lot of tail drag.
Yeah.
And he almost let it get away from him in Bethel. Where I jumped on the brakes and squawked the tires because he started to go, and he couldn't feel it. He didn't feel it start to go. I felt it start to go. And there ain't no stopping him once he gets his surgery. So,
just gotta
check him out. Huh?
Just got to stay hard on the rudders all the time and keep see what's going on with him.
Yeah, you gotta be alert. So anyway, they just didn't have enough work for him.
Right, when the caravan, of course, is anyone can jump in it. I mean, not anyone, but it's pretty...
Yeah.
Your first caravan you got in 95.
Yeah, I think it was 95 or 96.
Put it up in Kotzebue where you opened a new base.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of when it... That's how when I came along, it seemed like everything just started getting...
Well, it was so well received in Kotzebue at first. And
there weren't many caravans up here yet.
No, there weren't. The reason we got it is, that's the sole reason we got it. Herman's had some caravans down here, but nobody had them up north. And the winter before had been a real cold winter.
Uh-huh.
And Ryan's was shut down for I don't know how many days because of temperatures. And,
yeah.
The carriers up there, they said, well, shit. There we can provide a hell of a deal.
Because with the pistons, the 207s, you're looking at minus 40, they get less comfortable to fly.
they get impossible. I tell you what, when I first started flying, when I was living in Marshall and first started flying, in the first year I was there, I was parked down on the river. And Larry said, we cut off 40 below. So I said, okay, 40 below is good with me. I got up one morning and mine said 39 below. And I called all over town to see if it was, okay, anybody had 40 below. Nobody had 40 below.
So you had to go.
Shit, I got out there. Start taxiing out. This is down on the river. Start taxiing out, and pretty soon I can't taxi that turn. So I turn to the left. What the hell's going on? I look up. Of course, there's round on the top, but I got out. It's flatter than a pancake.
Yeah.
And it cracked the inner tube about that long. Just cracked. From the cold.
So it wasn't slipping on the rim like they all
no.
do. It was just a crack in the
It just cracked, dude. So I had to change that son of a bitch down there. And of course, probably was 40 below down on the river.
Definitely.
So I had to change that. And that whole week, it was right at that, between 35 and 40 below. And I had another flat tire. Two flat tires in one week. That 35 below is becoming something.
We know Jim told us once it was about 45 or 50 below up in like Ampler Cove upriver in Kotzebue. And I think I was managing there. We're like, God, Jim, we're going to find the 207 up there. We'll take the caravan and a small load. He's like,
God, it's not that bad. You know, once you get to 1,000 feet, it's probably, you know, above zero.
Yeah,
it's always an inversion.
Yeah.
Like, oh, Jim, great. Watch all fighters.
Well, it usually is. I mean, he's right there. But, you know, the thing is, you got to pump your tires up a little more.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it'd slip. You got to put about 50 pounds in there. It's that cold.
When he, of course, is still flying a 207 in Euclid, 1,000 hours a year, or the 180.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so you went from, then you just started getting caravans. You had a couple 402s.
Yep, we had 402s for a while. We had four of those at one time, I think.
Yeah, you might have had four. I just remember three. But yeah, I don't know.
We had the first one, and we bought one down in Alabama. Quebec, and then we had that one of the Zirkles. No, Billy Hateless we bought. And Zirkle was leasing this one.
Yep.
Remember that. We bought that one. So we just quit leasing.
I think you did buy it in the end.
Yeah.
I remember when it was up for sale.
Yeah, I think we had four of
them. Yeah. Then, of course, you went to the 406s and all turbines. And at this point, you are getting into the bypass mail. Now a big part of your...
We actually got into the bypass mail about 95 or 96. Actually, when Tom and I went through the fitness one time and got approved, and then we just never did it. Never did start scheduling, do anything. We had got approved back then, but then we had to go through this fitness, and it cost us, I don't know, about $10,000 to get our... Ken acted to get us through there.
Okay, well, Ken was operating.
But that was about 95 or 96 that we got that and started hauling bypass mail.
Okay, well, that's a big, I mean, you haul a lot of pastures now too, obviously, but the mail is a subsidy for the, it's also the way to get groceries out to the villages, of course, I mean,
yeah,
it's the only way it gets out there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a pretty good portion of our income right now. It's about 30,000 or 30% of our revenue for Hagelin itself.
Okay. That's
not
pretty
for,
good.
Not for overall, but for Hagelin.
Well, that system changed in the mid 90s. There were so many operators coming in with 1207, just trying to get a piece of the mail and not worry about anything. And I remember that was causing a lot of stress for everybody who's trying to fly passengers.
Oh man, yeah. That was after the turn of the century, I think, that we had that.
Oh,
they put that RISA in. That's only a few years ago, actually.
You're right. I'm getting my years mixed up.
Yeah.
That's how old I'm getting. It's probably
I think it was about...
2004?
Three, four years ago.
Okay.
That long.
That seems to have changed the nature of the business up here quite a lot. Things have changed a lot since I stopped flying.
Oh, yeah. It's got,
time
got rid of a whole lot of carriers. There's four operators out west now. Well, we are.
Yeah, that's the Hagler era.
Well, I'm not counting Ryan. It's
Ryan,
cargo only.
And they're back to Ryan now. So, so it's you, Grant, Barry.
And Ute.
And Ute, Ute doesn't do much, I don't think. Pretty
small.
They
do all 207s, but they got quite a few of them.
Oh,
they might be operating 10 of them now.
So they're back, they were really small for a while to get back.
Yeah, but they've got, we're starting to make a dent in them again, but they were pretty big in the close-in villages down there.
Well, it's not bad to have competition anyway. It's not like
competition's good.
Yeah.
I always say competition's good.
Especially if it's bad competition. That's what Ron always said. God, if somebody, if you have competition and not really good, you want to make sure they stay in business.
Yep. That's exactly right. There is.
Well, at this point, you have a base in Bethel, St. Mary's, Mountain Village, Antioch, Unalakleet, Nome, Kotzebue, Barrow, and Anchorage.
Once I moved out to 90, we didn't have anything in Mountain anymore, except we had a pilot in there once in a while.
Yeah.
It's not a base.
Yes, it wasn't a major base.
No.
Cool. Then mid-2000s, like 2005 or 2006, it looked like it made sense to merge with Frontier. Or change the business format again.
In the first instance, they wanted to buy us out. But they didn't want anything to do with the Bethel operation. So we had worked out a deal to sell out to them part of the operation and the rest to Grant. But neither one of them had a nickel to put toward it. So start thinking about that. It's not a good deal.
Yeah, plus you were kind of thinking it was time to retire again and decided you need to keep working.
So then when they come back again with, or then Jim got excited about merging them. Because we were trying to get our 121 and just not, just a struggle.
Taking more effort than it's worth.
It's costing us a lot of money. We probably spent close to $1 million just trying to get that thing.
Wow.
And we still weren't there, so we just said, this is the easy way to get it.
Frontier, they were already 121. Mm-hmm. That's like Dukovic family up in Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm.
They've been around for a while. So you've merged, so you didn't merge with Frontier, now you become a...
We didn't actually do a merger. We combined forces and we put both companies under one...
Parent company.
Because we still had to operate them as separate. We didn't want to do a merger because it wouldn't, there was no benefit to it.
Keep the 135, 135, and 121, mm-hmm. 121.
Right.
But it doesn't, that's really about the time I stepped out of, I think it was about 2007. I did the last stint up in Barrow, and then I was in Antioch for a couple weeks. And it seems like after that, you all have really gotten kind of exploded. You had Frontier, which is called Frontier Alaska for a while.
Yeah, we were going to name it, well, we did brand it as Frontier Alaska.
Okay.
But then when we bought Era, the realized that that was a much better known name. I mean, for the amount of passengers.
Right.
Frontier was only known up in
Fairbanks area.
And they're not very, company itself is not very well respected up there.
Yeah, and Haglund's never been, Haglund's a company where Bill never sought publicity all that much. It was always seemed like just do the work hard.
Oh, word of mouth.
Yeah, so you were known in Western Alaska. And Era definitely, I've always, they've had a very recognizable name.
Mm-hmm.
You bring them up down south, people will know them.
Yeah.
So then you bought Era, now you're Era Alaska. And it just seems hugely successful from what I can see. I'm sure it's more complicated,
it's
more
hugely,
of a pain in the ass, but
it's hugely anyway.
It sure looks good from the outside.
It always does. Things are never as good as what they seem, what they look for. A bystander, because all you see is, geez, I got to pay $180 to go there. Golly, you guys are making money. I don't see the money that you got to pay out to do that.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, the bigger you get, the more money you pay out, the less efficient the operation.
Very. Yep. If I'd have stayed if I'd have stayed operating by myself, it was very lucrative.
Yep.
Very lucrative.
High profit margins. So what? Looking back on it all, what would be your What are the moments that stand out? Like, you're like, wow, that was a cool moment. Flying or running a company or watching things grow, or just what are the moments that are kind of stand out? Are there any?
Oh, I can't say that there's, there were so many exciting things happened when you first started flying, when I first started flying up here, because everything was in it. I mean, there were so many experimental things that you did. In other words, judgment was in your pocket. It wasn't in somebody else's.
Right.
Somebody else didn't make decisions for you. You had to make decisions for yourself. Am I going to be able to land here? Am I going to be able to get off? What are the options if I don't? These things are all, you don't make decisions anymore.
You're not
supposed to.
Companies decide before you leave about where you're going to land.
Yeah.
You call them up on a sat phone or something. Ask what
you do. Nothing out of the ordinary.
Right.
No excitement in flying. Just my game. But flying I did out in Western Alaska was the best because country changes all the time. The river changes, and there's always something to see. There's moose. There's rabbits. There's fox. Lynx. Everything out there.
All it is for now.
Outstanding things, I don't know, I guess there's been moments, but there's so many of them that you can't have anything that's outstanding.
Cool, just a couple more questions. I'm curious, where do you think the airline's going to go from here? you don't have to give any business secrets, just sort of are you all just kind of going with the flow and see what happens?
Well, we got another Dash 8 coming. I think that's going to pretty much cover Alaska, or pretty much cover what we can do now.
Okay.
But there's no telling if Alaska decides to get out of the state. And they may, they may decide that it's not worth profitable for them
to that'd do, be Alaska
some,
Airlines.
Do some of these flights. Yeah.
Yeah.
Then they'll want somebody to take over those routes, and that's why they were wanting us to buy air in the first place, so they could, so nobody else could come up there and get at it. We have no ambitions to go to the lower 48 or do anything like that.
Okay. But are you happy with the run you've had from leaving Minnesota, coming up here?
Well,
it's
pretty amazing. I mean, I grew up dirt poor, so I guess that makes me tight with money, because they recycle.
You can all attest to that.
Huh? Yeah. And, you have to be. You have to keep a tight rein on it, because it's just, there's not a lot of profit in this kind of company. There never will be. I can't, it's every year you're worried about survival, whether it's going to, whether you're going to make it or not.
It definitely seems, it is, and you may not see it this way, it is the American dream, growing up dirt poor on a farm in Minnesota. You go flying in a Colt that landed on the road.
Yeah.
And now you're up here running a, 50, 60 airplane airline.
Well, it is, but you don't feel it. Feel that way, because it's not, it really wasn't my doing. I was forced into going into the business myself, kicking me, because I was having a good time. I fished, and I had a commercial fishing license, I made some money, and money's never been a paramount
driver.
Driver in my life. Right now we got to make money because you got to keep the business going. But as far as personal, you can only spend so much, and you don't,
Yeah, you drove around a van with spray foam all inside it for 10 years.
Yeah, and it never bothered me a bit. Door would come open when you go around the way, go around a curve, and the door would go open, but I had a seatbelt on, so it didn't fall out. I drive a 90 Jeep, and it's good enough for me.
Do you still have fun doing this, coming to work in the morning? Is it still
interesting? That's really, I'd retire, but it would be pretty boring if I did. I mean, I couldn't retire because I'm afraid that the business would probably go to crap. Until it gets on its feet, I won't be able to do that.
We've been waiting 30 years for it to get on its feet.
Yeah. You're right.
Cool. I think it's been a great run. So thanks for talking with us. One more question then.
Next year it'll be 30 years I've been in business.
Oh my cow. Running an airline, which airlines have a pretty small success rate from what I can tell.
But I was there to watch what I was paid, and that's what I did with accidents and everything else, to try to analyze and see what somebody did.
Fix another airline, go down, see what happened.
And don't do the same things. Try to avoid those things, but people get caught up in themselves and they don't realize that everybody's susceptible to the same things. So, it's just like accidents. I wish our guys would take these accidents and dissect them and say, what happened? Why did he do this? Figure it out themselves, because you can look at them and you can say, fucked up. The pilot fucked up. Why did he do that?
Yeah. And then you can learn something from it.
Yeah.
Obviously, I've been lucky because I've been in two accidents, neither one of which I was flying.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I can always look at what went on without, the FAA doesn't give a shit about what, if I was sitting in the right seat. And it's some of them, and they've both been really informative. Was a fantastic pilot, and hard time blaming him for it. I know that with Hagman, with you, Jim, Ron, we all had serious bumps in the road and always pulled through it. It seemed like that combination of you three and Hawkins at the beginning, Hawkins left shortly after I started, but that seemed like a really good combination of you three guys working together. A lot of pushing and pulling to come out at a good spot in the middle.
Yeah.
Seemed to work well. What advice would you give to someone who's starting out, just getting their private now, they want to come up to Alaska to fly? Any thoughts on what... just tell them to not do it,
No. There's still, it's still the best. What we have going right now with our co-pilot program is the best thing going.
Right.
It's a when I started flying commercially, I had 160 hours. I didn't even have a commercial instrument rating, but I had 160 hours, and I started flying commercial. And that's all it took.
And
now you got to have over 1,000 hours, you know, before anybody can hire you.
Get the insurance.
For a captain's job, you know. So we have something going there, and it's just, if people, especially young guys, if they just realize that everything doesn't have to be done today.
Right.
And take life as it comes, and don't worry about all this, oh, I got to make big bucks, and I got to do this, and I got to do that, you know.
Stick with it, let it happen, it'll all come about.
You're not going to hell when you come up here. No matter where you go, there you are.
Yep, enjoy it.
You might as well enjoy every place you are, because that's the only place you're going to be, you are at that time.
Thanks for chatting. Appreciate it.
No problem.
We hope you liked this interview. If you found it useful, visit oddballpilot.com for more stuff like it.